Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Today's episode is a replay of our conversation with Brooklyn Decker from October 2018. Decker grew up outside of Charlotte, where Southbound is based, and visited our studios on a trip to see family. Two updates since we talked. One, her TV series, Grace and Frankie, just started season number 6 on Netflix. And two, Finery, the company she co-founded to help women design their wardrobes, was bought by the personal styling service Stitch Fix. So lots of things going on in Brooklyn Decker's life. Here's our conversation. I want to start out by talking about zits. So I saw not long ago you had an Instagram story, which has disappeared now, so I may not be remembering it exactly right. But basically you came on and you said, I have these two giant zits today. Mm-hmm. Here's how we're going to get rid of them. And you showed the makeup and you showed the people working on it and that sort of thing. And that, it really struck me that we used to see people who, for lack of a better word, are celebrities, either at their very best, you know, photoshopped and perfectly lit, or at their very worst, sort of this paparazzi National Enquirer. Mm-hmm. But you and a lot of other people have sort of staked out this middle ground where you're kind of showing your flaws, but also saying, here's how I deal with them. Everybody has this. How do you decide, like, how much to show of yourself?
That's a funny question. No one's ever asked me that before, so well done you. You know, my relationship with social media, I think, is unique in that when Twitter started, I think it was 2008 or 2009, something like that, when I first signed up. And this was when I was exclusively modeling. I hadn't started acting. I hadn't started a business. And so I was coming at it from a place where I was a woman who was depicted in a way that was completely unrealistic, that was completely photoshopped, completely made up, did not at all represent who I was or what I felt like as a human. And it felt very false to me. And granted, I had an incredible job and it afforded me incredible opportunities, but it wasn't me. It didn't feel authentic at all. And so when I started social media, it was a way for me to actually strip all of that away and really connect to people as me, as Brooklyn Decker, the person. And so my relationship with it has always been like, yeah, you might see a picture, you might see something on TV or whatever, but I feel like what I put out there is really me, and it's content, obviously, that I've created myself. It actually doesn't even feel like content. It's just my day-to-day life. And so instead of really starting social media to create sort of this facade, I think that's how a lot of people use it, and to create sort of a beautiful image of what life should look like, I actually use it to just reveal what life is actually like and who I actually am as a person. And it almost felt like I was being rebellious when that happened, you know, in 2009, when I first signed on to Twitter specifically. And then, of course, as social media has evolved, I've gotten on to Instagram. And I think that's the, I don't do the Snapchat. I'm a little too old for that. But yeah, so to answer your question in a very long-winded way, it's not really contrived. I just tend to put out there what feels real in the moment, what I think is either like so ridiculous that it's funny or something I know friends of mine or other women are going through. But it was very liberating for me to be able to kind of show me as a person.
I know back, or at least now, you're kind of your own boss and you can basically do what you want. Back before that, when you were maybe working as a model or something, were there people telling you, don't do that?
I think there were people at that time who were very surprised by what I put out there. I think now it's different. We have so many women or people in general who have made careers on being honest and candid. You look at like Kelly Oxford, who started as a mommy blogger and is now a writer. And you look at Busy Phillips, who now has a nighttime television show because she's so candid and open and honest with who she is. Chrissy Teigen's a great example of it. So now you have women who are being incredibly candid. But at that time, I definitely don't think a lot of people were using the media medium for that. So I never had people telling me not to do it, but I definitely had clients who were very surprised by what I would put out there.
Yeah, so I know recently I've seen at least a couple others. One, you were, I guess, breast pumping backstage somewhere or something like that.
Yeah.
And then another one that I watched several times because it was hilarious, where your baby had basically puked in your face.
Yeah, all over my face.
And so all that, was that just sort of an instantaneous thing? We have to put this, we have to kind of show people what
it's like. Yeah.
I guess what I wonder about that is, now that you've sort of established that as you're a person who does that sort of thing, do you feel like sort of a need to share these things now?
No, I really don't. I mean, there's so much that I don't share that when I – the baby puking on me, as I'm like saying these out loud, I realize how ridiculous they are. But the one with my baby puking literally in my mouth, my husband pulled out his phone because instead of helping me, he thought the funny thing or the better choice in that moment would be to actually humiliate me. So he took out his phone and started filming.
And by the way, was that the better choice in that moment?
At the time, yes, because I'm really happy we now have, you know, video evidence to show our daughter one day. But he actually took the video out and we just originally sent it to my parents. And then my parents were laughing so hard and we were laughing so hard that I just put it on social. And then as far as the pumping goes, yeah, I was at a work event and I had to walk away from the work event to pump. And typically I've been in that experience before and I always feel, or been in that situation before, and I always feel really guilty about it. This sounds ridiculous, but unprofessional to leave work to go do something like pumping. And that should never feel ridiculous or unprofessional because it's a perfectly natural thing to do as a new mother. And so when I was at that specific work event for Finery and I left, and my co-founder, who's a woman, and our head of marketing, who's a woman, they were like, yeah, go do your thing. It felt so cool. And at that time, I'm like, oh, this is how women should feel when they have to tend to the needs of their baby. They should feel totally supported by their work situation, by their employer to be able to do this. And so in that situation, I definitely felt an obligation to share, just saying like, this is what it should be like. Like, yeah, it really stinks to have to leave, you know, a work event and pump, but it should be easy and it should be supported. And this is what it should be like for women.
I want to go back to those early years when you were here. By the way, for people who are listening, we're in Charlotte. You grew up here. Mm-hmm. And my understanding for years when I read about you is that you were discovered in a mall. Mm-hmm. And then as I was reading up over the last few days, I hear maybe that's not true. So how did you sort of become a model in the first place? And then I want to go back a little before that.
So it's funny. It kind of was like a two-prong approach. One of them was that I was at the mall. Carolina Place.
Okay.
And I was shopping for like a homecoming dance dress or something like that. And we kept seeing this girl who was my age. I think I was, you know, 14 at the time. She was my age and she was with her mom. And clearly we were on the same mission. And so we kind of kept seeing each other and kept sort of laughing and saying hi. And they came up to us and said, we recognize you. Do you model with, at the time, this agency was called Evolution? And I had no idea what they were talking about. Turns out we actually ran track at opposing high schools. She was at Providence and I was at East Meck at the time. So that's how we recognized one another. But they thought that we had worked together through modeling. So they told me, well, you should really get into this. There's this guy. His name's Scott Cooper. He's still in town. He's wonderful. He's trustworthy. You should sign with him. It's a great way to make some cash. And so we kind of took that. They planted the seed. We're like, okay, that's interesting. And then sort of at the same time, I had a substitute teacher whose daughters were both models. And she also was like, this is a really great way to do some local catalog work and save up for school. And so I had sort of these two events happen really close to one another. And I started talking about it. My mom said, is this something you're actually interested in? Because if you are, we can, you know, meet this agency. And I sort of thought, why not? Like, it wasn't something, you know, when you grow up, I mean, I was in Matthews, which is outside of Charlotte. When you grow up in Matthews, like, you don't see people becoming models or actors or anything, right? And so it certainly wasn't a realistic career path, but we kind of thought, why not? And that's how it started.
And so before that, was that sort of thing on your radar at all? I hate to ask this because I know it just sounds weird. I mean, did people come up to you and say, wow, you're gorgeous, you should be a model, that sort of thing?
People, that's interesting. It's funny that you asked this. I'm giving such long-winded answers, but it's funny
We have a long-winded show.
Good. Because the whole gorgeous thing, people did say that to me growing up, but I believe that kind of people say that to their friends' kids, you know? Like, sure. People always say that to my kids. They said it when both my kids were little, you know, seven-week-old blobs, you know, and you can't tell if they're gorgeous or hideous. They just look like a newly birthed blob.
Sure.
So I think people say that to their friends' kids, but yes, people did say that to me. And as a sort of side tangent, now having a daughter, I always was telling my husband, like, I don't want to tell her she's pretty. I just want to tell her she's smart and capable and strong. And then we were meeting with a friend of ours who's very brilliant, works at Google, like, you know, former military, Harvard business, like a genius person. And they said to us, I have a friend whose parents never told her she was beautiful. And now she doesn't believe she's beautiful. And he goes, I believe every little girl should be told she's beautiful. And it's sort of like, it completely changed my mentality, because this whole time I'm like, I don't want to tell her. I don't want her to find value in that. But I think it's important to tell your kid that she is smart and she is capable and she is strong and she's beautiful. Anyway, so yes, people did say that to me, but I don't think it's because I actually was beautiful. I think it's just because they were being polite. We're in the South after all.
Looking back on those years that you did that, what were those years like for you? When you were traveling around the world doing that, do you kind of look back on them fondly? Do you look back on them as like, wow, that was stressful? How do you see them with some perspective?
I have mixed feelings about those years, because on one hand, before I started modeling, I had never been to New York. I had never left the country. I didn't have a passport. We couldn't afford to travel. So anywhere we went, we would drive to. And so on one hand, it afforded me so much opportunity and I was able to see the world. And I think that in itself is such an education. I really was able to get a handle on business and financial planning and all these things that you're not taught in school, you know, that are crucial for someone young entering adulthood. And so I really so appreciate modeling for that reason. And there are certain relationships from my past that I still have that are so meaningful and important to me. A lot of people at Sports Illustrated, for example, they've just always set the bar high for how they treat the models. And they actually treat you like you're human. And they really work on helping you cultivate a career. And there's a lot of allegiance I have to them. But on the other hand, I look at what was important. I look at what people in power said. I look at people telling me, again, I would never be successful unless I lost 10 more pounds. And I was like a size 2'4" and, you know, 19 years old. It just was absolutely ridiculous. And so I kind of look back and say, like, why did I ever listen to any of that? It was so ridiculous. We were just taking pictures. And I kind of laugh at how seriously I took some of that. So to answer your question, I have mixed feelings about it.
Is there a moment that you could think of or a story or a scene that when you were in the middle of all this, like, you know, one of the top models in the world, felt like this is part of my everyday life, but now that you look back at it, it looks really absurd?
I think I always saw the absurdity in it because I did grow up in Matthews, North Carolina, and my parents were in the medical profession, so I didn't grow up like... That world always seemed absurd to me, and I could always kind of laugh at it,
right,
while I was a part of it. So, no, I mean, I definitely took to heart what people would say to me, criticism they would give me, especially people who were responsible for hiring me. But I kind of always saw the absurdity in it.
I always see these photos of like a model, like you're in Egypt and you're riding a camel or something. And you look back 20 years, like, what was that all about?
Yeah. I was like in the beach with in the ocean with a horse once. And I'm like, did I ride the horse into the ocean? Like, what are we doing here? You know? And it was beautiful. And it was really cool because we were in Israel and there was a horse in the ocean and its owner was actually washing him off or cooling him off. So it was very cool. It actually was sort of an organic moment. And we just asked to approach and take photographs. But looking back, yeah, you kind of see how funny some of these situations are.
We have a mutual friend, Chris Stone, at Sports Illustrated.
Yes. And love Chris.
I emailed Chris and asked him what to ask you about. And he said I should ask you about your videos with Paul Zimmerman.
Yes.
Dr. Z.
Yeah.
She says Z says,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Where you guys did football picks together.
Yeah.
My impression of that was you taking like Haverhill on the video went every week, trying to get him to crack a smile, mm-hmm, and mostly failing. Mm-hmm. What are your memories of that?
That's a big part of it. Yes, that was sort of the joke. Like, I was sort of a chihuahua, sort of nipping at his heels, and he was the serious, well-respected, curmudgeon-y sports writer. And what I love about Dr. Z, I mean, that show did so much for my career. It was this weekly show online. I think the episodes were like 3 to 5 minutes. We just were giving our picks for the games that week, and it was a showrunner, actually, who now is the showrunner for This Is Us. He wrote Crazy Stupid Love. He was fresh out of college, and he watched that show and had me do his first pilot for NBC, which was also my first acting gig, which was my first pilot for NBC. And so, like, that came out of that show. And then my husband was watching that show and realized, hey, I like this girl. I want to meet her because of She Says, He Says. So much came out of that. And we just were in the basement of the Sports Illustrated building in New York talking about football. And Dr. Z was so protective and really invested in my career and really wanted to know, who are you meeting? You don't need to talk with them. They don't have a good reputation. This person's a creep. Stay away from them. Like, he was so protective.
And so off the screen, he was good.
He was wonderful. He's like a secret softy. He took care of his team, his producers, writers. One of them is actually now on the Dan Patrick Show. We still keep in touch. Andrew Perloff. He just really took care of the people around him. He was obsessed with his wife. I mean, still is. But yeah, he was incredible to work with.
And I, you kind of said this in passing as you were answering this question. That's how you met Andy Roddick, right?
Yeah.
So he saw the show and looked you up, basically?
Yeah, it's really embarrassing. He watched the show, and this is sort of the gross side of what we did. Like, it is not uncommon for a random person to reach out through your agent. Men do that, and it's typically not sort of warmly accepted, and it wasn't something I'd ever responded to. And so Andy's attorney, who is actually a good friend of ours, reaches out to my agent saying he wanted to get in touch with me. He watched the show.
Sounds like there should be a formal letter. My client, Mr.
Yes.
Roddick,
isn't
like
it
to,
weird?
Socially see
yes.
your client.
It's so bizarre. It's like, it's a call and it's like, hey, he's interested. Can he share his phone number? And that's what it was. Like, let me leave his phone number and she can reach out. And I never responded. And I think he reached out once a month for 5 months. And I was living in New York and all of my friends were in college and I had just moved from North Carolina and I didn't have any friends in New York and I was kind of having a hard time living there and I really missed home. And so my manager, who I'm still with to this day, said to me, you need to make friends at some point. I hear this guy is really smart and really funny and he has a foundation for kids. He's supposed to be a good guy. Why don't you just reach out? He's like, worst case scenario, you have a bad first date and it's a funny story. And so my manager dialed his number in my phone and put the phone up to my ear. And that was the first call.
That sounds like a classic Hollywood love story.
I mean, it's really embarrassing, but we just have to own it at this point. You know, like 11 years and 2 kids later, it worked.
I have a story. I'm not going to tell my friend's name for embarrassment reasons, but he graduated from UNC and moved to New York about the time you were there. Mm-hmm. And had started hanging out with some North Carolina people there. One of his friends said, there's this great girl named Brooke that you should meet, who's in New York. And she kept saying, you ought to meet this girl, you ought to meet this girl. He never followed through. And of course, he found out like a year later that it was you.
Wow.
Major regret in his life.
He really missed out.
Yeah, because you were, it sounds like you were lonely those first few
months. Lonely. I was lonely.
This
he could have been.
This is going to hurt even worse.
He could have been the love of my life and he missed out. That's a shame. Do I know him? You can tell me afterward.
Yeah. I'll be glad to introduce you.
Yeah, then, 11 years too late.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did you always want to act? I mean, was this something that was sort of a little kid dream of yours? Or is it something just that as you were in this other field, you saw, I'm sure you met a lot of people who did it as a model?
Yes and no. I mean, again, like growing up in Matthews, it just wasn't even a viable career. It wasn't something you chose to do.
Well, let me stop you there then. When you were 13, 14, before the modeling people came around, what was your, did you have sort of some idea of what you might want to be one day?
I mean, I wanted to be a veterinarian. That's like the big thing I remember wanting to be. But I think every kid wants to do that at some point because they love animals. You know, I don't think that's especially unique. I did do local theater. So I had acted. There was a very clear interest in it. I did school plays up until high school. And at that point, I was just too busy with, you know, sports and other extracurriculars to do theater. But I had done theater until, you know, I was 14 years old. So yeah, there was an absolute interest. But I don't think I ever thought it would turn into anything.
Yeah. And then at what point did you think, I want to try to turn this into something?
So, again, when I moved to New York, I was really missing school. All of my friends were in college. I don't want to say I regretted not going to college, but at that time I was really missing out on that experience because everyone I knew was having it. So I really was looking for some sort of education, you know, because when I was a model at the time, you know, I would work because my career wasn't going super well early on. I would work, you know, once a week, once every couple of weeks, and you would have all these days where your head would be spinning and you wouldn't be doing anything. And I believe productivity is the key to happiness. So when you're not being productive, you know, you're kind of losing your mind. And so my manager, who now that I'm saying this out loud has really led me to a lot of great decisions, said to me, why don't you study acting? You can work with an acting coach. You can read plays. Like, just it'll give you something to work on and read when you're traveling. And again, at that time, it was 2005. You could take online courses, but you had to be a full-time student to take online courses. They didn't have exclusive online college. And so I met with an acting coach and we started reading Tennessee Williams, and I thought it was really beautiful. And I had read a lot of Shakespeare. I took a class on Shakespeare in high school. Like, I'd read a lot of that, but never Tennessee Williams. And I just thought the writing was so beautiful and I liked saying the words. And so we started working together, and then I started auditioning. And then once I booked, I think it was 2010, I booked 3 films in 1 year. I said to my manager, okay, I'm done modeling. That's it. And I did one last shoot for Sports Illustrated, again, because they're like family. And that was my last shoot. Granted, now it's also intertwined, right? Like, actors are doing campaigns and models are in films and television. Like, it's all so blurred together these days that I still technically shoot, but it's not modeling. It's like to do promo for Finery or for Grace and Frankie or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Were you ever like nervous when you were a model? And I'm asking that because I also want to know if you were really nervous when you started acting.
I was nervous as a model, but modeling is more forgiving just because there's Photoshop. so you know that if you really mess up, they can piece something together to make it work. Like, you have that cushion. And for acting, I mean, I still get nervous. Every scene, I'm nervous. I still, and I don't know if that's like, I don't know if I have imposter syndrome. I think I sort of do, or if it's just because I'm working with, you know, such a high caliber of talent, but I still get nervous to this day.
Everybody has imposter syndrome except the people who really should have it.
That's right? Good to know.
Yeah.
Good.
Everybody thinks they're going to get fired tomorrow.
Honestly, it's a conversation I've had out loud several times.
Sure.
Yeah.
There was a guy, Ron Green, who was a sports writer at The Observer mm-hmm. for 50 years. He retired. I came up to him at his retirement party. I said, I'm just amazed you kept it going for so long. How did you do that? He said, I always thought I was going to get fired the next day.
You know, I really like that.
And so
it's like a fire was lit underneath them.
Well, but not only that, it's an irrational fear, mm-hmm. I think, especially for somebody like that. But it's something that does keep you motivated, whether it's, I think it's kind of unhealthy in a way.
Oh, yeah.
To always feel
it's
like
very unhealthy.
Tomorrow the axe is going to fall.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I think it's super common. It's like, it's everybody feels that.
I respect you sharing that with me. Thank you.
Well, anyway.
Thank you.
So I one thing I want to ask about your early acting was, I always wonder what it's like when you're pitched or when you pitch yourself to act in one of these big budget action movies, because I'm always trying to see that meeting. And so you were in Battleship, mm-hmm. and in Battleship, I'm seeing somebody pitching it. It's just like the old kids board game, except there's aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, is that how it got pitched to you, or how did you end up sort of buying that? And when you're in a movie like that, how do you play it?
That's a funny question. So with a lot of these big budget blockbuster actions or tentpoles, that you don't see a script. And so for Battleship, all I knew is that Peter Berg was directing. He was fresh off of The Kingdom and Friday Night Lights, mm-hmm. which we all love.
Sure.
And highly respected, high energy director. And he's like an athletic director. Like, he likes to be physical, and that's something I really respond to. And so I knew that I loved Peter Berg. And then they just told me it was Battleship, and they didn't really tell me anything else. And so when we met, he then tells me there are going to be aliens. I was like, wait, what? There are aliens?
I don't remember that.
I don't recall aliens. But it's funny, like, when you're auditioning for it, I auditioned for a really big film maybe a year and a half ago, and they give you dummy sides. So they give you a dummy script. It's basically they set up a scenario that will happen in the film, but it isn't the real dialogue. The character names aren't there. The circumstances aren't accurate. So you're basically playing, you know, on your imagination, and then they somehow apply that to real casting, which is really interesting. So I had read for this a few times, and then they finally brought me in to meet Pete, and he got in my face and he was like, there are aliens and I want you crying and I want snot coming out of your nose and you get in a car accident and aliens are coming to get you and you take out an M4 because you're with an army vet. He lost his legs. Greg Gadson, he's actually a real army vet. You're going to love working with him. And I'm like, okay, you're taking all of this in. He's like, and action. And so it's just like this. And those are the moments, like you were saying, in modeling, do you look back and say, like, what? That was ridiculous. And I do. I just look back. I'm like, how is this my job? How is this real life for anyone? You know, it's absolutely crazy. And the circumstances are so fun and wild and unpredictable. But that's how you audition for something like that. And that's what they tell you.
When Southbound comes back, we talk to Brooklyn Decker about what it's like as an actor and a woman to work with two legends, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all. If you like Southbound, let me tell you about one of my favorite podcasts about the South, the Bitter Southerner podcast. It's hosted by my buddy Chuck Reese, who was a guest here on Southbound a while back. Chuck runs a digital magazine out of Atlanta that's also called the Bitter Southerner, which features some of the region's finest writing. On his podcast, through Georgia Public Broadcasting, Chuck explores things like the mysteries of the Southern accent and how the Music Maker Relief Foundation is keeping the blues alive. His work is sunk deep in our southern soil. So go ahead, give a listen to the Bitter Southerner podcast on NPR One and wherever else you get podcasts. Now, let's get back to Southbound and our conversation with Brooklyn Decker. So now you're on this, which I always want to call Frankie and Grace, I think because of Will and Grace.
Oh, yeah.
But it's Grace and Frankie. Mm-hmm. With this like Hall of Fame cast of actors, Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda, Martin Sheen, Sam Waterston. For people who may have not seen it, could you just sort of set up the premise and tell people what your role is?
So our pilot episode, we just finished our fifth season. I believe it's coming out early 2019.
Right.
But the first episode, you have these lifelong sort of friends. You have Martin Sheen and Jane Fonda and Sam Waterston and Lily Tomlin. And they've been married for 40 years. They go to dinner together. They have a big announcement. The men have a big announcement. They've run a law firm for many years. And the women, Jane and Lily, think that the men are finally announcing their retirement. They can go and travel the world and finally, you know, pursue all the things that they've wanted over the years. And at the dinner, Sam and Martin announce to the ladies that they are leaving them because they are gay and have been in a relationship with each other for the last 20 years. So that's episode one of the series.
Hit the ground running.
Yes. And then you see the fallout. And Jane and Martin have two daughters. I play one of their daughters. And Lily and Sam have two sons. And so you have basically the four leads and then their four children who carry the show.
And you have been through some crap on this show.
Like, yes, I have.
I don't know how much to... Hey, let me ask you this, because the last season came out in January.
Yep.
What's a reasonable spoiler space? Like, is it okay to tell people what's happened to you in the last... Is it okay to tell people how, like, the last season ends?
I think it is. I think it is, because at this point, it's been out you know, for a while. And I think with spoiler alerts, it's like if you haven't watched it in 6 months, it's on you.
6 months. That feels like a good.
That feels that, right.
That feels like a good cushion. So yeah. Not only has your marriage sort of fallen apart, mm-hmm. but you and the other children have sort of come together and decided that Grace and Frankie are kind of unable to keep this home that they've made together. Mm-hmm. And basically, you kind of put them out to pasture.
We do.
And so there it's a show with certainly comedic elements, like any show with Lily Tomlin, and it's going to be funny.
Of course.
But there's also some pretty heavy drama there.
Yeah.
And what has it been like to sort of have to maybe swing back between those two things and doing a show?
That's a good question. I think we struggled with it early on. You know, when I look at season one, June, Diane Raphael, who is brilliant, is she's one of the best comedic actresses I've ever worked with, if not the best. She thought we were doing a straight comedy. I thought we were filming Family Stone. Other people thought other things. And I think that's what was so tricky about the writing initially is like it could go heavy drama or it could be, you know, sitcom comedy. And I think we struggled with it early on. I think we were definitely, it took us a little while, probably half a season, if not a full season, to find our tone. And then we found it. And I think the reason it has become such a hit and it resonates with people is because it does toe that line so well. And I think if you look at most people's real lives, they are full of drama and sometimes they can be melancholy, hopefully not too often, but that's obviously the case for a lot of people. But again, like there's a lot of humor in life, and I think the show does a really good job of dealing with both in 30 minutes, which is no easy task.
No. And just by being around those actors, I was thinking probably those four leads probably have 200 years of acting experience, mm-hmm. maybe. So what are some things you've learned from just being around that set?
I'm learning as much as I can by osmosis. they are brilliant, and what... They're so different and their approaches are so different to acting. You know, you look at Jane Fonda and she's so technically perfect. And then you look at Lily Tomlin and technically that's just, it's not a priority of hers, right? But she is so free and improvs all the time and is so in the character at every moment that she walks onto set and might not be on her mark, but she's delivering a raw, authentic performance. And so like their approaches are equal and powerful, but totally different. And so the one commonality between the four of them is that they have incredibly full lives. They all have families and they all have stories and they're all involved in politics and they're all activists. And when they're not shooting the show, they're authoring a book or they're directing a play or they're acting in a play or they're growing crops on a farm. I mean, it is so crazy. Like their experiences run the gamut. And I think it really allows them to be incredible performers because their life isn't necessarily their work. They just have very full lives. And so it's funny, that's not really an acting note, but I see that. I'm like, oh, having a rich life makes you a really compelling actor because you're coming to it with a ton of experience. And that's what they all have in common.
I guess it is kind of an acting note, right? Have a life that makes you a better actor.
Yeah, exactly.
So I feel the need to ask this because I feel the need that every time there's an interview with a woman, professional woman, certainly someone in entertainment, all these Me Too stories that have come out over the past years, I guess I have a sort of a two-pronged question to ask you about it. One, if you have any stories of your own that you've thought of as all this stuff has happened over the years. And two, obviously you're on a set with two women who have spent a lot of time in Hollywood and thereabouts in the film industry and TV, and I wonder if the three of you or a larger group have talked about these things at all.
So I fortunately have not been in a Me Too situation that's as severe as any of these stories we're hearing about. And I feel so lucky to have not experienced what a lot of these women have experienced. That being said, I think we have tolerated behavior for years that now I'm starting to understand, oh, we don't have to tolerate that anymore. Oh, that's unacceptable. It's okay to say, no, I'm not going to meet with this person because they have a really horrible reputation. And I remember specifically with Harvey Weinstein, you know, I didn't know him personally. We met publicly, like I was never alone with him. But I remember hearing that he was a creep from a lot of people. And it was just known, and agents and managers would continue to send their actors to him, knowing that they would be in situations alone, and basically be like, okay, go perform. And I remember modeling. There was one photographer specifically who an agent said to me, you know, he might ask you to take your clothes off, and he does really sexual photography, and you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. But if you do, just know that he tends to be really loyal to those people and use them in campaigns. So you don't have to do it, but it could definitely help, you know, down the line with your career. So as an 18 or 19 year old.
I was going to say, that puts you in an impossible spot.
Impossible, right? Because you're like, I feel really uncomfortable and I don't want to do this, but will it advance my career? Unfortunately, I, for whatever reason, I don't think it was a strength thing. I don't know. I just was too scared and said no and left, you know, like I don't.
So he did ask.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. He asked for my phone number, and I stupidly gave him my phone number because I felt weird saying no. And then he would text me to do photo shoots and to come to his house, and I just never responded. So I didn't engage. But I was fortunate that, like, I could leave, and I had the option to leave, and not as many women were that lucky. But I look back, and I just think, why did any agency or business say to these women, some of whom were underage, go meet with this guy. We know he's a predator. We know he's dangerous. We know that you could be put in a compromising situation, but it's totally your choice. You don't have to do it. I mean, that's just completely unacceptable. And it was something that was accepted for so long, both in film and in fashion. I think just because the nature of the business is so gray. I mean, like, let's be honest, you're kissing people. You're a married woman. I'm a married woman, and I'm kissing people who aren't my spouse on camera. You're meant to play husband and wife. I mean, there are lines that are gray just by nature of our business. And I think that's why we were so, I guess, tolerant for so long. But it's just exciting to see, like, oh, yeah, that's not okay. And as agents specifically, yeah, we're not going to send our models or actors to see this person anymore. We're not going to put them in an unsafe situation. I think that's where we're starting to see the tide really change.
And among the women on the set, has that been a topic of discussion?
I not too much. I mean, I think more than anything, what we've been talking about is raising funds so that women can, the Time's Up campaign, so that women can, in other industries outside of entertainment, who don't have the means to necessarily get an attorney involved, Time's Up is now doing that. And Jane's on the board of Time's Up. So she talks about raising funds and trying to support, you know, the farmers in our country who, you know, have been disenfranchised or taken advantage of or put in compromising situations, to give them the resources they need to stand up for themselves. And so we've talked about the Time's Up campaign from sort of a logistical standpoint, but something, and Jane didn't talk to me about this, but something I read that she said was, you know, she was asked about the Harvey Weinstein scandal specifically. And she said, you know, I think, because of my age, I didn't deal with a lot of that, which is, I mean, thank goodness she didn't, but it's also gross in its own right, you know? So I read that she said that. And other than that, like, the great thing about Lily and Jane is they're not really dwelling on the past, and they're just talking about how can we help the women of the future, yeah, inside and outside of our business.
Yeah. So speaking of business, I want to ask about this business you've started. I have to say, I'm a guy, I own like 5 shirts and 3 pairs of pants.
Yeah.
This is probably not for me.
Right.
But you have this thing called Finery. Could you kind of explain what that is?
Yeah. So Finery is a tech company. We launched it about 1.5 years ago. We just got our first patent, which is very exciting for technology.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So we are basically, when you look at like iTunes, before we had iTunes, we had racks and racks of CDs. We had books of CDs in our car, in our house, everywhere. And we never thought there would be a day where we could put all of our CDs on one single device and have everything at our fingertips. The same goes for your closet. When you think about everything, every system we have to manage our banking, to manage our music, to manage our travel, I can set my thermostat from my phone if I'm in another state. I can look at my kid's baby monitor from another state, but I can't actually see what's in my closet. And I think that's completely ridiculous, because women will spend more money on their clothing than their education, which is shocking but true. And the second most valuable room in the house behind the garage is the closet. And so you're spending so much mind share and so much money on your clothing. And I'm not talking about fashion-loving women. I'm talking about the every woman who just has to get dressed for work or has to get dressed for their friend's engagement party or their interview, whatever it may be. There's nothing out there to help us manage it. And so Finery is a solution. We launched a year and a half ago, and it's an app in the App Store, and we have a desktop product, finery.com, and we get all of your online purchases in a wardrobe for you automatically and basically are a wardrobe concierge for you. We help you get dressed. We let you know when things go on sale. We let you know when your items need to be returned. Anything you have to do with your wardrobe, we manage on your behalf.
So if I get up in the morning, just theoretically, mm-hmm. and I have a business meeting,
yep.
you can say, here's what you've got in your closet that you put together to go to this business meeting.
That's exactly right. So you open it up, you look at your closet. You can do one of two things. You can either create a look yourself so that when you wake up, it's there instead of going into your closet and rummaging through everything. You just go in and get dressed and leave. Or you can, let's say you have that business meeting and you're like, I want to wear my black skirt today. You click on that black skirt and we found that a lot of women were searching for look inspiration via Google and Pinterest. And so we have a visual search technology that basically finds a ton of different looks with black skirts and puts them right in front of you so that you can save that inspiration. So when you go into your closet, you say, oh, I like that black skirt look with a gray sweater and a boot for this meeting. Great. I'll go into my closet, grab those items and go. So the idea is just to save you the 2 hours a week that it takes women to get dressed.
And I assume this is done sort of algorithmically somehow. There's not like somebody back in your office going, well, that would go well with that, right?
Yes and no. We started manually because we had to learn, right? I mean, machine learning has to get its data from somewhere. So we started manually putting in looks, the most common looks that you would see on Instagram, on, again, Google, on Pinterest. And now we actually were doing machine learning. And we, again, have the visual search technology, but we're also testing this really cool remixer now where, again, you pick any one item and we serve you up looks with that based on just algorithm. And so the more people that use it, the longer that it's around, the smarter it gets. But the idea is we want to style you with what you have. We want you to shop less and wear what you own.
Where did this idea come from beyond the closet in Clueless that I think everybody remembers watching?
Yes. Everyone says it's finally, I have the Clueless closet. Finally. Yeah. So my business partner and I, we always wanted to go into business together. She used to work at CNN. She was an anchor. So news media, similar to both modeling and acting, there's a timeline, right? Like you have a finite career for most women. And so she was ready to move into something where she had a little bit more control, as was I. And when I'm not working, I have a lot of free time. And so I thought, like, I want to do something. I want to have a business. I want to do something that I can really create and grow myself and kind of take ownership of. So she and I thought of several different ideas, all of which involved selling more stuff to women. There's nothing wrong with that. I am a consumer myself. But we both said, you know what? There's a lot out there, right? Like there are plenty of e-commerce sites that are great and doing great things. There are a lot of brands out there that are doing really well. I don't really think there's a space for us out there. But there's no technology that's actually applied to the woman's closet. And we believe because it took women to create it. And so when we saw sort of this technology, which is essentially just email parsing, when we saw this technology working in several different avenues, but not the closet, we thought, okay, we can build this. And that's really how it started. It was like we have tech to manage so much of our life, but nothing to help us manage our stuff.
How do you guys make money from this?
We don't. We make no money.
Theoretically, when you make money, how will
theoretically.
That happen?
So there are a couple of different avenues. One is re-commerce. I mean, if we can see what you have, think about how cool it would be for a woman to have her closet in front of her. She scrolls through, sees all of her stuff and realizes, oh, I have that black blazer I haven't worn in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years hanging in my closet. Why don't I sell it? We could either open it up to re-commerce sites so that they can bid on their items and actually make our users money, or we could set up a community aspect where they sell to each other. There's also a subscription. A big chunk of our, 80% of our users actually say that they would pay for a subscription basically for styling. There are a lot of other platforms out there not doing what we do, but paying for styling essentially. So we could always do a subscription. We haven't done it yet, but there's a data play here too, where kind of like Instagram, you're basically feeding the algorithm what you like, and then Instagram is putting product in front of you that you respond to. The same goes for us. We certainly believe in wearing what you have, but let's say you're like, hey, look, a lot of our users say, okay, now you see what I have, tell me what to buy. So there's an opportunity for any retailer to come in and say, okay, I see that you like this brand, and I see that you buy this wash of jean. Well, let me put this in front of you because you don't have it. I think you'd really like it.
I want to kind of finish off here by talking about the South a little bit. This podcast is sort of South related. You live in Austin now, right? Mm-hmm. Do you consider Texas to be the South?
That's a really good question. I don't. I consider Texas to be Southwest. And I think Texas is its own island.
Right.
Like, because Southwest is like Arizona, New Mexico, Texas. Texas is its own island.
Okay, fair enough. I saw a clip. I don't remember how long ago it was now. you were on like a Steve Harvey show or something, and he asked you if you could live anywhere, where would you want to live? And you said you're in North Carolina.
Yeah.
So tell me why.
I miss the sounds of the South. I miss the crickets at night. I miss seeing lightning bugs. It's funny. I love Austin. Oh, my goodness. It's such a cool place. The food's amazing. The culture's great. It's just super funky. It's all about keep Austin weird. And the city really likes to keep it weird. And I love that. But I remember the first time I went there, I went from New York. And Andy said, isn't it so green here? Isn't it beautiful? And compared to most of Texas, it absolutely is, you know. But it's green with cedar, so when you actually, like, hold the ground, it's rubble. And, again, it's beautiful. I mean, we live there. It's home, and it's incredible. But then I brought him to North Carolina, and he's like, oh, this is a different level. I wasn't expecting this. And it's like you have the old overgrown trees, and everything's lush, and you just feel like you live in a forest. And I just – there's something – Texas and North Carolina are different as well, because I think with Texas, it takes you 8 hours to leave the state. If you grew up in North Carolina, you spend time going to Virginia, to Tennessee, to Georgia, to South Carolina. You just drive everywhere, and there's, I don't want to call it European, but there's sort of like a neighborly approach to travel and to community here, because there are so many different communities and states that are so interconnected. And it's not like that in Texas. And so those are things I really miss about North Carolina.
And when you're here, are there certain things you feel like you always have to do, like somewhere you have to eat or somewhere you have to go or anything like that, or little touchstones for you?
Yeah. So, well, we always go to the mountains. We go to Cashers, North Carolina. We spend a lot of time there. And so we go on as many hikes as we can, and we go to the lake, and we just spend time outside because, you know, nature is medicine, and it's the best kind of nature up there. So we do that. And then when we're in Charlotte, it's new, so it's not like a tradition I grew up doing, but Yafo Kitchen is a place where we always stop. We love it so much. We're like, why isn't this in Austin? This is so delicious. So we always stop at Yafo Kitchen. But it's funny in Charlotte because, you know, I left in 05 and it's grown so much since then. And there's this food, you know, this burgeoning food scene that wasn't there when I was here. We're always about trying new places. So we're always trying the new restaurants. We, you know, did Stoke recently, and I'm trying to think where else. Just all over. Like, our thing here is, like, let's try what's new. Let's see new Charlotte.
And you're a big, like, Panthers fan, right?
Yeah.
And Tar Heels, too, maybe?
Yeah. Well, yes, though I'm a bad fan since I had children, but yes. I grew up a Panther fan and a Tar Heel fan, yes.
But maybe not watching as consistently.
I mean, I watched the Panthers last week. I watched the first half, and then I got on a flight.
Yeah.
Have
you ever done the drum, the keep pounding thing?
No.
Oh, you'd be a natural.
Should I
that.
Do it?
Oh, you should have. I'm sure they would love to have you do it.
Panthers, will you guys have me come out?
It's pretty awesome.
I haven't been to a game in, well, that's not true. I went to Denver. I went to Denver to see them play the year, it was a season opener the year after they lost
after the Super Bowl.
Yeah. So I was there, but that was the last game I saw in person. I haven't been to the stadium in years.
Yeah,
we'll have to change
now.
That.
It's better.
I'm excited.
All right, one last thing. So I know you still travel a lot now, mm-hmm. but certainly you've spent your whole career being on the road and all these exotic places and that sort of thing. When you are out there, what little piece of the South did you take with you? Whether it was something tangible or just something kind of inside you?
Two things. One, country music, which is comical because when I grew up here, I really resisted. I was like, it's such a cliche. I live in North Carolina. I'm not going to listen to country music. And I really fought it for many years. And then when I started working in Los Angeles, I missed the South so much that all of a sudden I got into country music. I mean, this was 10 years ago. I just, as someone who wasn't living in the South, just grew an enormous appreciation for it. And so country music, especially when I'm traveling, because it feels like a connection to home. And then I think there's a, you know, I think empathy is the buzzword right now, especially in business. It's like, how are you an empathetic leader and companies that lead with empathy? And I think that's something that the South has been doing this whole time. They're like, yeah, yeah, we're in on the secret. We've been doing it this whole time. I think there's just a really great sense of empathy here that I don't see in other places, especially bigger cities, and especially internationally. And so that's something I think I have been called by coworkers an empathetic you know, colleague. And I think in the South, that's something that's just ingrained in you from a very young age. You ask people how they are. You're neighborly. You help people when they need it. You go up to the woman crossing the street and ask her if you can carry her groceries. I mean, it sounds very, you know, Leave It to Beaver, but I feel like it's a way of life that people subscribe to here.
If you had seen Brooklyn Decker when she came by our studio, you might not have recognized her. She was wearing a t-shirt and faded jeans. No makeup, or at least not enough to notice. She had a Band-Aid around the end of one finger, and the polish on the rest of her fingers was chipped. She's still a beautiful woman, no doubt, but not in the perfectly lit and carefully photoshopped way of a supermodel. What I thought about after she left was how warm she was, and how funny, and how she thought about what she said before she said it. Now, I ain't gonna lie to you. The 14-year-old me would have had a huge crush on the Brooklyn Decker in the swimsuit issue. But I'm a grown man now, and what I found out was I like the real Brooklyn Decker better. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.